Chapter 9. Keepers and actuaries were born and died. Still official routine inclined to these nudged sticks, as if they were pillars of the Constitution, and still the exchequer accounts continued to be kept on certain splints of elmwood called tallies. In the reign of George III, an inquiry was made by some revolutionary spirit, whether pens, ink, and paper, slates and pencils, being in existence, this obstinate adherence to an obsolete custom ought to be continued, and whether a change ought not to be effected. All the red tape in the country grew redder at the bare mention of this bold and original conception, and it took till 1826 to get these sticks abolished. In 1834 it was found that there was a considerable accumulation of them, and the question then arose, what was to be done with such worn-out, worm-eaten, rotten old bits of wood? I dare say there was a vast amount of minuting, memoranduming, and dispatch-boxing on this mighty subject. The sticks were housed at Westminster, and it would naturally occur to any intelligent person that nothing could be easier than to allow them to be carried away for firewood by the miserable people who live in that neighborhood. However, they never had been useful, and official routine required that they never should be, and so the order went forth that they were to be privately and confidentially burnt. It came to pass that they were burnt in a stove in the House of Lords. The stove, overgorged with these preposterous sticks, set fire to the paneling. The paneling set fire to the House of Lords. The House of Lords set fire to the House of Commons. The two houses were reduced to ashes. Architects were called in to build others. We are now in the second million of the cost thereof. The national pig is not nearly over the stile yet. And the little old woman, Britannia, hasn't got home tonight. Now, I think we may reasonably remark, in conclusion, that all obstinate adherence to rubbish which the time has long outlived is certain to have in the soul of it more or less that is pernicious and destructive, and that will someday set fire to something or other, which, if given boldly to the winds, would have been harmless, but which, obstinately retained, is ruinous. I believe myself that, when administrative reform goes up, it will be idle to hope to put it down, on this or that particular instance. The great, broad, and true cause, that our public progress is far behind our private progress, and that we are not more remarkable for our private wisdom and success in matters of business than we are for our public folly and failure, I take to be as clearly established as the sun, moon, and stars. To set this right, and to clear the way in the country for merit everywhere, accepting it equally, whether it be aristocratic or democratic, only asking whether it be honest or true, is, I take it, the true object of this association. This object it seeks to promote, by uniting together large numbers of the people, I hope, of all conditions, to the end, that they may better comprehend, bear in mind, understand themselves, and impress upon others, the common public duty. Also, of which there is great need, that by keeping a vigilant eye on the skirmishers thrown out from time to time by the party of generals, they may see that their feints and maneuvers do not oppress the small defaulters and release the great, and that they do not gull the public with a mere field day review of reform, instead of an earnest, hard-fought battle. I have had no consultation with anyone upon the subject, but I particularly wish that the directors may devise some means of enabling intelligent working men to join this body on easier terms than subscribers who have larger resources. I could wish to see great numbers of them belong to us, because I sincerely believe that it would be good for the common weal. Set the noble lord at the head of the government, when Mr. Layard asked him for a day for his motion, let the Hon. Gentleman find a day for himself. Now, in the names of all the gods at once, upon what meat doth this our Caesar feed, that he is grown so great? If our Caesar will excuse me, I would take the liberty of reversing that cool and lofty sentiment, and I would say, first lord, your duty it is to see that no man is left, to find a day for himself. See you, who take the responsibility of government, who aspire to it, live for it, intrigue for it, scramble for it, who hold to it tooth and nail, when you can get it. See you that no man is left, to find a day for himself. In this old country, with its seething hard work millions, its heavy taxes, its swarms of ignorant, its crowds of poor, and its crowds of wicked, woe the day when the dangerous man shall find a day for himself, because the head of the government failed in his duty in not anticipating it by a brighter, and a better one. Name you the day, First Lord. Make a day. Work for a day beyond your little time, Lord Palmerston, and history in return may then not otherwise find a day for you, a day equally associated with the contentment of the loyal, patient, willing-hearted English people, and with the happiness of your royal mistress and her fair line of children. Speech. Sheffield, December 22, 1855. On Saturday evening Mr. Charles Dickens read his Christmas carol in the Mechanics' Hall in behalf of the funds of the Institute. After the reading the mayor said, he had been charged by a few gentlemen in Sheffield, to present to Mr. Dickens for his acceptance a very handsome service of table cutlery, a pair of razors, and a pair of fish carvers, as some substantial manifestation of their gratitude to Mr. Dickens for his kindness in coming to Sheffield. Henceforth the Christmas of 1855 would be associated in his mind with the name of that gentleman.
Mr. Charles Dickens, in receiving the presentation, said, he accepted with heartfelt delight and cordial gratitude such beautiful specimens of Sheffield workmanship, and he begged to assure them that the kind observations which had been made by the mayor, and the way in which they had been responded to by that assembly, would never be obliterated from his remembrance. The present testified, not only to the work of Sheffield hands, but to the warmth and generosity of Sheffield hearts. It was his earnest desire to do right by his readers, and to leave imaginative and popular literature associated with the private homes and public rights of the people of England. The case of cutlery with which he had been so kindly presented should be retained as an heirloom in his family, and he assured them that he should ever be faithful to his death to the principles which had earned for him their approval. In taking his reluctant leave of them, he wished them many Merry Christmases, and many Happy New Years. Speech. London, February 9, 1858.
At the anniversary festival of the Hospital for Sick Children, on Tuesday, February the 9th, 1858, about 150 gentlemen sat down to dinner in the Freemasons' Hall. Later in the evening all the seats in the gallery were filled with ladies interested in the success of the hospital. After the usual oil and other toasts, the chairman, Mr. Dickens, proposed prosperity to the hospital for sick children, and said,
"Ladies and gentlemen, it is one of my rules in life not to believe a man who may happen to tell me that he feels no interest in children. I hold myself bound to this principle by all kind consideration, because I know, as we all must, that any heart which could really toughen its affections and sympathies against those dear little people must be wanting in so many humanizing experiences of innocence and tenderness, as to be quite an unsafe monstrosity among men. Therefore I set the assertion down, whenever I happen to meet with it, which is sometimes, though not often, as an idle word, originating possibly in the genteel languor of the hour, and meaning about as much as that knowing social lassitude, which has used up the cardinal virtues, and quite found out things in general, usually does mean. I suppose it may be taken for granted that we, who come together in the name of children and for the sake of children, acknowledge that we have an interest in them. Indeed, I have observed, since I sit down here, that we are quite in a childlike state altogether, representing an infant institution, and not even yet a grown-up company. A few years are necessary to the increase of our strength, and the expansion of our figure, and then these tables, which now have a few tucks in them, will be let out, and then this hall, which now sits so easily upon us, will be too tight and small for us. Nevertheless, it is likely that even we are not without our experience now, and then of spoiled children. I do not mean of our own spoiled children, because nobody's own children ever were spoiled, but I mean the disagreeable children of our particular friends. We know by experience what it is to have them down after dinner, and, across the rich perspective of a miscellaneous dessert to see, as in a black dose darkly, the family doctor looming in the distance. We know, I have no doubt we all know, what it is to assist at those little maternal anecdotes, and table entertainments illustrated with imitations, and descriptive dialogue which might not be inaptly called, after the manner of my friend Mr. Albert Smith, the toilsome ascent of Miss Mary, and the eruption, cutaneous, of Master Alexander. We know what it is when those children won't go to bed. We know how they prop their eyelids open with their forefingers, when they will sit up, how, when they become fractious, they say aloud, that they don't like us, and our nose is too long, and why don't we go? And we are perfectly acquainted with those kicking bundles which are carried off at last protesting. An eminent eyewitness told me that he was one of a company of learned pundits who assembled at the house of a very distinguished philosopher of the last generation, to hear him expound his stringent views concerning infant education and early mental development, and he told me that, while the philosopher did this in very beautiful and lucid language, the philosopher's little boy, for his part, edified the assembled sages, by dabbling up to the elbows, in an apple pie which had been provided for their entertainment, having previously anointed his hair with the syrup, combed it with his fork, and brushed it with his spoon. It is probable that we also have our similar experiences sometimes, of principles that are not quite practice, and that we know people claiming to be very wise and profound about nations of men who show themselves to be rather weak and shallow about units of babies. But, ladies and gentlemen, the spoiled children whom I have to present to you after this dinner of today are not of this class. I have glanced at these for the easier and lighter introduction of another, a very different, a far more numerous, and a far more serious class. The spoiled children whom I must show you are the spoiled children of the poor in this great city, the children who are, every year, forever and ever irrevocably spoiled out of this breathing life of ours by tens of thousands, but who may in vast numbers be preserved if you, assisting and not contravening the ways of Providence, will help to save them. The two grim nurses, poverty and sickness, who bring these children before you, preside over their births, rock their wretched cradles, nail down their little coffins, pile up the earth above their graves. Of the annual deaths in this great town, their unnatural deaths form more than one-third. I shall not ask you, according to the custom, as to the other class, I shall not ask you on behalf of these children, to observe how good they are, how pretty they are, how clever they are, how promising they are, whose beauty they most resemble. I shall only ask you to observe how weak they are, and how like death they are. And I shall ask you, by the remembrance of everything that lies between your own infancy and that, so miscalled second childhood, when the child's graces are gone, and nothing but its helplessness remains, I shall ask you to turn your thoughts to these spoiled children in the sacred names of pity and compassion. Some years ago, being in Scotland, I went with one of the most humane members of the humane medical profession, on a morning tour among some of the worst lodged inhabitants of the old town of Edinburgh. In the closes and winds of that picturesque place, I am sorry to remind you, what fast friends picturesqueness and typhus often are, we saw more poverty and sickness in an hour than many people would believe in a life. Our way lay from one to another of the most wretched dwellings, reeking with horrible odors, shut out from the sky, shut out from the air, mere pits and dens. In a room in one of these places, where there was an empty porridge pot on the cold hearth, with a ragged woman and some ragged children crouching on the bare ground near it, where, I remember as I speak, that the very light, refracted from a high damp-stained and time-stained house wall, came trembling in, as if the fever which had shaken everything else there had shaken even it there lay, in an old egg box which the mother had begged from a shop, a little feeble, wasted, wan, sick child, with his little wasted face, and his little hot, worn hands folded over his breast, and his little bright attentive eyes. I can see him now, as I have seen him for several years, looking steadily at us. There he lay in his little frail box, which was not at all a bad emblem of the little body from which he was slowly parting. There he lay, quite quiet, quite patient, saying never a word. He seldom cried, the mother said. He seldom complained. He lay there, seeming to wonder what it was about. God knows, I thought, as I stood looking at him, he had his reasons for wondering, how it could possibly come to be that he lay there, left alone, feeble and full of pain, when he ought to have been as bright, and as brisk as the birds, that never got near him. Reasons for wondering, how he came to be left there, a little decrepit old man pining to death. Quite a thing, of course, as if there were no crowds of healthy and happy children playing on the grass under the summer sun within a stone's throw of him, as if there were no bright, moving sea on the other side of the great hill overhanging the city, as if there were no great clouds rushing over it, as if there were no life, and movement, and vigor anywhere in the world, nothing but stoppage and decay. There he lay looking at us, saying, in his silence, more pathetically than I have ever heard anything said by any orator in my life, "Will you please to tell me what this means, strange man? And if you can give me any good reason, why I should be so soon, so far advanced on my way to him who said that children were to come into his presence, and were not to be forbidden, but who scarcely meant, I think, that they should come by this hard road by which I am traveling. Pray give that reason to me, for I seek it very earnestly, and wonder about it very much, and to my mind he has been wondering about it ever since. Many a poor child, sick and neglected, I have seen since that time in this London, many a poor sick child I have seen most affectionately, and kindly tended by poor people, in an unwholesome house, and under untoward circumstances, wherein its recovery was quite impossible. But at all such times I have seen my poor little drooping friend in his egg box, and he has always addressed his dumb speech to me, and I have always found him wondering what it meant, and why, in the name of a gracious God, such things should be. Now, ladies and gentlemen, such things need not be, and will not be, if this company, which is a drop of the lifeblood of the great compassionate public heart, will only accept the means of rescue and prevention which it is mine to offer. Within a quarter of a mile of this place where I speak, stands a courtly old house, where once, no doubt, blooming children were born, and grew up to be men and women, and married, and brought their own blooming children back to patter up the old oak staircase which stood, but the other day, and to wonder at the old oak carvings on the chimney pieces, and the airy wards into which the old state drawing rooms, and family bedchambers of that house are now converted are such little patients, that the attendant nurses look like reclaimed giantesses, and the kind medical practitioner like an amiable Christian ogre. Grouped about the little low tables in the center of the rooms, are such tiny convalescents, that they seem to be playing at having been ill. On the dolls' beds are such diminutive creatures, that each poor sufferer is supplied with its tray of toys, and, looking round, you may see how the little tired, flushed cheek has toppled over half the brute creation on its way into the ark, or how one little dimpled arm has mowed down, as I saw myself, the whole tin soldiery of Europe. On the walls of these rooms are graceful, pleasant, bright childish pictures. At the bed's heads, are pictures of the figure which is the universal embodiment of all mercy and compassion, the figure of him who was once a child himself, and a poor one. Besides these little creatures on the beds, you may learn in that place, that the number of small outpatients brought to that house for relief is no fewer than 10. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.